Building a company from nothing is freaking hard. Us entrepreneurs are expected to deal with unimaginable challenges and somehow keep a cool head through it all. This is The Art of Entrepreneurship, and I'm your host, Jackie Hermes. I grew my company, Excelity, from 0 to 7 figures with no partners and no funding. The Art of Entrepreneurship is a show where we cut through the BS and dig into what it actually takes to start and grow a company. If you give me your time, I promise it won't be wasted. Now let's get to work. Hello and welcome back to The Art of Entrepreneurship. Today we're getting into a topic that you probably aren't very familiar with, but you definitely should be, and that is that your brain lies to you. You've probably heard the saying that there are three sides to every story: your side, someone else's side, and the truth. And that's basically what I talked to Busy Gold about today. She is a tech founder who invented something called brain pattern mapping. It is a strategy that's proven to be 98.3% accurate in decoding the subconscious patterns that drive human perception and decision making. And it's an alternative to traditional mental health models, which is something that I enjoy exploring. I think exploring alternatives to anything traditional is definitely always worthwhile, right? And then we can all make our own decisions. In our conversation today, we get into how leaders and founders behave and how we can change those behaviors that we may or may not like, those that are conscious and subconscious. So thanks so much for tuning in today. Okay, so I want to appropriately set the table for the conversation that we are going to have today. Your work revolves around human behavior, and I want to talk not just about human behavior, but about founder and leader behavior, which I've always thought is super interesting. I thought that just reading about your background and the work that you do was really fascinating. I think everyone's going to love this episode today. I think that we are maybe, as leaders, not all as great as we might think. Like, a lot of leaders and founders think that they are just like amazing. And I think we all have a little bit of work to do. Tell me a little bit about your work. What is brain pattern mapping? And why do you say that our brains are liars?
Every single human being on planet Earth has unique patterns of self-deception that get us to justify or excuse our own maladaptive behaviors. These are all rooted in early childhood inputs. And brain pattern mapping is an algorithm that I developed that scans 200 historical data points to predict patterns of thought, behavior, and decision-making with 98.3% accuracy. And when we know where you're placed on the brain pattern spectrum, we know exactly what patterns of self-deception and underlying motivations drive all of your decision-making and relationship cycles.
Oh, fascinating. Okay. So how do you go about evaluating something like that? Like, tell me what that process looks like.
Brain pattern mapping takes about 20 minutes. It's something that you do entirely online. The diagnostic evaluation has nothing to do with narrative-based questions, which is a very important foil, I think, to the mental health establishment at large, because most of traditional talk therapy is one part observation on the side of the therapist and then one part client self-reporting. The hypothesis of break method as a whole is that clients aren't able to accurately self-report because of the filter of self-deception. Brain pattern mapping uses these 200 historical data points that any single person can fill out. I even have kids do this evaluation with their parents all the time. And based on the aggregate scores to these historical data points, we're able to a very high degree, track 9 different markers that tell us how you perceive reality, what emotional addiction cycle comes from that perception, and then what your behaviors look like cascading over a period of chronological time.
Interesting. I think a lot of people don't even realize that everyone perceives reality differently, right? Like, they think that their truth is the truth, and they don't really think about other people's perception of the truth. And they say, you know, like, there's always 3 versions of every story. It's your side, the other person's side, and then what's the actual probably truth is. What do you say to that?
I have an analogy that I use in break method that I think brings it a little bit more into something concrete. So let's say that the way you were raised puts on a red pair of glasses lenses, right? So everything effectively that you see in your world and every interaction will look like a tint of red. Mm-hmm. And how I was raised might give me a pair of blue glasses. Everything I see will have a slight tint of blue. when you and I come together in a conversation, or maybe we're unwinding some sort of area of misalignment or conflict, you're going to see everything red, I'm going to see everything blue, when the reality is everything is some shade of purple, right? It's something in between.
Yeah.
What break method does that is so powerful for company founders or employers is it helps you understand how your employee, for example, would have that unique distortion on what might have taken place in objective reality, so that you can either pivot or preempt what you're saying in a way that bypasses that sort of distorted filter. So in a way, we're able to translate our language into something that the other person can receive. Because quite often people only know how to do things essentially one way. You've probably heard that saying, like, the way you do one thing is the way you do everything.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Well, right. It's like about, I feel like people say that about returning carts in the parking lot.
You're either a cart returner or you're not. And it's not usually a little bit of both.
Right.
Right. So the way that you do one thing is effectively the way that you do everything. And this can certainly be the case with communication. People have their authentic way of communicating that feels really justified for them, maybe even feels productive. But there are certain ways that we'd have to be able to adapt our communication style to be well received by the other party. I like to look at all communications like throwing a football. You wouldn't throw a football the same way to an 80-year-old granny as you would to a 3-year-old. And you certainly wouldn't throw a football the same way to a high school football player. Right? You need different tactics for different people. And most people don't have that adaptability and flexibility, which when you first brought up, what do most leaders and founders have that might be unique or different is that in general, there are two select places on the brain pattern spectrum where leaders, founders, entrepreneurs tend to be situated. And what makes them uniquely equipped for this role is that they are naturally flexible and adaptable, rather than rigid and fixed in how they like to do things. So as we brought up the shopping cart example, I immediately started to giggle because sometimes I take it back and sometimes I don't. I'm like one of those rare outliers where like it's not the same for me. Example would be I have a 15-year-old daughter who's special needs, and if she's waiting in the car and I have to go all the way back in to take the cart back, sometimes I'll leave it in a place that's, you know, somewhat reasonable. I'm not going to leave it in the middle of the road like a terrible human being, but I might not walk it all the way back. If I have nobody in the car, I can walk it all the way back. So some people really aren't that way. If somebody very rigidly thinks I'm a bad person if I don't return the cart, they might, even with a special needs child in the car, still methodically take the time to go and walk it back. Where my style is much more to be in the present moment and figure out what the present moment needs so that I can pivot and be adaptable, which isn't really available to most people. It's not something that comes naturally, that ability to be adaptable. It's typically more of a trauma response, actually, where you have to learn how to be resilient and pivot as a way to keep other people happy or de-escalated as a way to keep moving forward, feeling safe rather than being self-centered and just doing what I want to do.
Yeah. Interesting. I think the idea of being able to be flexible to people is really important and often overlooked in business. We have communication preferences for each other where we will talk about like how we like to receive feedback, and we'll share our scores to different things like the DISC or the Enneagram or different things that kind of indicate how you might like process information or how you might communicate and stuff like that. So this is a much more scientific way to do something like that.
Exactly. And I think there's one piece of it that's also really important when we look at the rewiring side, because there's how we're naturally positioned, which is based on our brain pattern. And that, unfortunately for us, tends to create ruts where we do get stuck in repetitive patterns and we do lose that ability to be adaptable or be able to pivot on the fly. When you're explaining how you share these sort of, you know, I don't like the DISC test and things like that, so kind of share preferences. One of the things that I've found when we bring break method into corporate environments, it's important to know what that person's preferences are or how they naturally like to receive information. But I would say it's equally as important to teach them what they are not naturally good at so that you can build in intentional moments to oppose those patterns. Because just because something's your preference doesn't mean that that's actually the only way that that person should communicate to you, because we all need to learn how to actually have more dynamic range. And we could actually set ourselves up for failure by restricting the communication to, I always need to have things this way. That will actually perpetuate the pattern rather than break it. So when we do work with corporate environments, we do try to help team leaders understand the communication patterns of their employees while also working with the employees themselves to build more of that dynamic range so that they can learn to do things that don't come naturally. Maybe speak up earlier or take a chance on self-trust and share an idea that might scare them with somebody that's up above them that could maybe take action on it, where maybe they would naturally keep it to themselves and then silently build resentment that they're always getting looked over or passed over, right? So we always want to make sure that we're trying to do both, understand the natural style, but also teach them very strategically to oppose it.
Yeah. Okay. That makes a lot of sense. And I think it's also just not realistic that you're going to be able to deliver feedback or communicate with someone in the way that they prefer at all times, especially because people do see the world in all of those different, you know, like through the different lens colors, like you were talking about. So there's absolutely no way that we could possibly understand everyone's color that through which they see the world and adapt to them. So that totally makes sense.
And each type of role requires something different. So that's one of the things that we do with brain pattern mapping in corporate environments is we also see, is that person's brain pattern a good fit for the role that they're in? Because often what we end up doing is shuffling people on a lateral track because their brain pattern is actually perfect for something else that they might not have considered, but it's essentially a setup for the way that the managers need to manage that employee. So instead of trying to tailor things to that one person, sometimes a lateral move is actually in the best interest of all parties involved.
Which is fascinating because most people look at stuff like that and they're like, nope, don't want to move laterally. I want to do this. But if you can scientifically prove that it makes sense, then okay. All of this is making a lot of sense to me. I have some specific questions around, I guess, founder and leader behavior that I think listeners would find interesting that I'd love to ask you.
All right, y'all, it's shameless plug time. I want to take a quick break to chat with you about Excelity, my full service marketing agency. For the last 12 years, we've been working closely with B2B software and service companies. Now we are expanding and looking for growth stage companies with a bold vision, but maybe lacking the marketing strategy or resources to get there. Or hey, you might have resources that just aren't working out. We definitely see that all the time. At Excelity, our team gets results and we have a ton of fun doing it. I'm sure you can tell that from listening to this podcast. So if you or someone you know is a fit, check us out at excelitymarketing.com or reach out to me directly on LinkedIn.
I think that a lot of founders really pride themselves in being self-aware. And I can't remember where I saw that you said something about how awareness isn't enough for the actual behavior change. Tell me why that is.
Awareness of the behavior, especially for a very smart person, can also be piggybacked with seemingly rational justifications for why, although they're aware of it, they should still perpetuate the behavior, which is why truly awareness is not enough. Also, the bulk of my practice with over 15,000 clients typically are people who have been in therapy for extensive periods of time where they could tell you all of their problems and the things that they do, but they can't yet stop doing them. So awareness is an important first step because we have to come to terms with the behavior and we have to face it head on. But if we're not also equipped with how to strategically oppose those patterns with precise action, we won't ever be able to stop doing them. So the bulk of my work is focused on the action piece of it so that you can essentially build new neural pathways so that those things actually start to become a new pattern rather than to constantly rely on willpower or trying to kind of force yourself through it. Because willpower for most people is not available. But going back to this sort of founder leader grouping, they typically do have high levels of willpower. So they can kind of force themselves through things where potentially other people on the brain pattern spectrum would not be able to, because in general, founders and leaders have a high level of self-efficacy, a high level of self-trust. They are typically highly committed and passion-driven, almost to the point of tunnel vision where they can lose sight of other things. Mm-hmm. So when you first kicked off this conversation, you talked about how potentially there's some downsides of that, and there absolutely are some downsides. So if I may, I'll drop into the downsides.
Please.
When you can be that tunnel vision focused on something you're highly excited about or passion driven or committed to, sometimes your intimate relationships are the first to start to fall apart. It can be challenging to manage both. Another thing that can be a challenge is being able to pull yourself out of concentration into something that happens spontaneously in your environment, maybe like a husband tapping your shoulder or a kid asking for your attention without reading like you're agitated. So that's something that could turn into spiraled conflict over a long period of time. Another thing that could happen would be more aligned with workaholism. It can be challenging to not see everything in your business as urgent and needing to be done right now. And that's part of what makes you excel in those founder leader roles, but it's also something that can make parenting and relationships really challenging. And that's not to say that you can't also thrive in those areas, but in my data exploration, those things will not come as easily as your work will. They will be fraught with more division, and you will need to work harder at those things to excel.
Oh my gosh. This entire time I've been thinking about like, I'm aware of plenty of my own patterns that I know about, but I sure as heck can't figure out what to do with them. And also I think a lot of founders have that tunnel vision where when you're taken aside, you're like, ugh, like mom's busy right now. I have three kids, three teenagers. And when they want to talk, they're like yapping. And when they don't want to talk, they have disappeared, right? And so you
and that's always to, when you want to talk, hey honey, what are you doing? And then you're just getting ignored.
And they're like, yeah, nothing, school's boring. But if I'm focused on something and they want to talk, then you have to be able to, you know, like show them that you care and take yourself out of whatever you're focusing on. And it does come out as agitation. I was just talking to my son about that. So you're definitely hitting home, I think, with a lot of these topics, and I think they will resonate as well. And you kind of tapped on one of my questions that I had, which was patterns that show up in high performers that masquerade as strengths but are actually weaknesses. And you touched on a few of them here, which are like that tunnel vision, which makes you successful, but it also can harm your personal relationships. What else falls into that category?
So I think that one, even what we just were talking about, that has another version of it as well, which is much more fleeting, but that same sort of tunnel vision could also be put into the relationship itself. So let's say somebody that's an entrepreneur or a leader goes through a divorce and then they're dating again. It's highly likely that dating again may then turn your tunnel vision into the relationship temporarily, where then you start to let your business become a dumpster fire. Because the reality is that that focus is usually directed in one very specific direction and then can't actually be reasonably or equally spread out in all facets of your life. So that's one thing that can happen is that, let's say that that person is dating where they're not yet married, relationships, at least in those early stages, could also be the reason that you maybe neglect parts of your business as well. Because as good as you all are at multitasking, you might not be as good as you think you are. You might be able to handle and manage many things at the same time in your mind, but when you're actually putting in the focused effort, that's where that tunnel vision is going to kind of get you trapped, and it's going to be really hard to not let one thing fall away on the sidelines. In my podcast, I did one episode on love bombing, and an interesting little tidbit here is that that is actually one of the characteristics that people, especially nowadays, will attribute to love bombing. Oh, well, when we first started out, you were all in, you were always available, you were always this, you always wanted to do all these things. And then all of a sudden, now you've just pulled away. Well, for a founder or an entrepreneur, that could easily be because they realized, oh crap, I just let all of these things I've been working at completely fall by the wayside. And then because that urgency now comes front and center, they're pulling away without properly communicating why they're pulling away. And the other person feels like they've love bombed when the reality is they weren't able to actually split their attention in a way that was well managed. So that brings up my point number two, which is sometimes the minutiae of communication, especially as it relates to things that are more emotional, may not actually be the best qualities of an entrepreneur or leader. They're much more the cut the crap, let's get this done. I see the problem. Here's the solution. Let's just move this forward. And that's what makes them thrive in business. But that doesn't translate well to intimate relationships. You can't just cut the crap and get things done. That's not the way intimate relationship connection works. So sometimes the softness or the patience required for relationship communication actually falls by the wayside or doesn't happen at all. In an intimate relationship setting, that person could appear maybe more cold or detached when they might actually have a lot of feelings on the inside, but it's not being matched with the right type of emotional communication.
Mm-hmm. That makes a lot. I feel like you read my life story before this. So here we are. Yep. That makes a lot of sense. And especially I went through a divorce years ago and did the tunnel vision dating thing and all of that. So I know.
I did it too earlier on in my career. And I look back and I'm like, damn, really let things go sideways during that period.
Yeah. You know, it happens. And what can you do but move forward and recover from it?
And that's one other quality that founders and leaders typically have is the ability to reset and move forward very quickly, mm-hmm. which also, when translated into an intimate relationship setting, can only further the appearance that you're cold and detached. Yep. So an example would be when I have a fight with my husband, when it's over, I can go to sleep and move on with my life. And there have been times that he's woken me up and been like, babe, how can you sleep right now? And I'm like, I thought our fight was over. He's like, but I'm still not over it. I'm like, but it was over, right? So there can be this cold, logical look at even things like relationships where when something's over, your brain will almost close that tab and be like, this isn't productive to ruminate on. I have to reset for tomorrow, which people that are very emotionally driven on the right side of the brain pattern spectrum, they won't understand it. And they will likely misinterpret the cues as intending that you don't care or that you're somehow cold or detached, which is not necessarily the truth, but I can understand why it translates that way.
Yeah, absolutely. I can too. And I think that I've been on both sides of that, right? The more mm-hmm. emotional side and the reading as colder side. So I definitely get that. I think as leaders, we often think that we're really highly rational decision makers too. Like I usually think of myself as a pretty rational person, but then I look at other leaders who are making decisions and I'm like, oh, that's not that rational. Then you think back on the decisions you're making and you're like, am I as good at decision making as I think? Maybe not. What are some of the like subconscious lies that we are telling ourselves in that area that are holding us back as leaders or entrepreneurs?
So if you look at the brain pattern spectrum, which I'll briefly just describe visually so people can kind of hold the vision, envision an XY axis that is divided into equal left and right halves. So on the left side of the brain pattern spectrum, you tend to, as you move from the center to the left, you see hyper-independence increase, self-trust and self-efficacy increase, and you start to see workaholism also increase because essentially the further you go to the left, the more mission-driven and purpose-driven you are and relationship awareness can start to kind of fall by the wayside. So you're also increasing your situational awareness as you move to the left-hand side. And what tends to happen is, you know, as human beings, we only have so much capacity, and you've heard the saying, where your awareness goes, there you go too. So if we look to the left and we're very focused on situational cues, we're often going to be missing the smaller pieces of relational inputs in our environment. So what ends up happening when we instead go to the right side is we see instead of hyper-independence, dependence start to build. So it may start with more codependence or more of a leaning toward desiring to co-regulate, all the way to the far right side of the spectrum where someone may in fact actually become entirely dependent. Maybe a 40-year-old still living at their parents' house, can't get or keep a job, still expects people to take care of them. We also see as we move to the right-hand side, a fixation on relational cues, which often can be a byproduct of our own deeper insecurities, right? We're actually projecting onto the other person and trying to interpret their eyebrows or their voice tone and making it mean something about us, which it may have nothing to do with us at all. And when we're that focused on relational cues, we often start to miss out on situational awareness cues because our awareness is focused on the relationship. So if we look at these two sides of the spectrum, there are only two small clusters where we see entrepreneurs and leaders. The middle of the left, there's a small square where we see two pattern variants actually have extremely high levels of leadership and leadership. Top 1% of virtually every organization you see is going to be clustered right there. Then the far right side, just before you get to the grouping where people tend to be completely dependent, feel futility in life, and basically don't try at all, there's this very small cluster that I call the cowboy position that tend to be where many podcast hosts are situated. And it's kind of this interesting little hypothesis that I have that the more data we pour into it, the more I'll be able to prove it. But at this point, there have been roughly 200 or so candidates that have fit the bill for this cowboy position on the far right side, where they are fixating on what others think about them. But because it has become so overwhelming, they've essentially decided to kind of throw it all away and be reckless. So there's still that kind of underlying desire to care about their reputation and care about what people think. But they've also adopted kind of this wild, reckless hair of like, why not? I'll just do what I want. So it's almost like this pendulum swing sort of behavior where the people on the left wouldn't have that pendulum swing behavior. They'd be much more logical, rational. So as soon as you started saying like, why would some leaders do this and then some leaders do this? Typically, the leaders that can actually be more reckless and emotional are that cluster on the right in the cowboy position, and those who are much more methodical and strategic and maybe still impulsive, but there's always like a matrix problem that was solved before they took the action. Those would typically be the people that are placed on that left-hand side. And it would really just be this kind of perfect blend of the ability to take action quickly, the ability to trust yourself, and either the ability to trust yourself so much that you know you can handle what's going to come your way, or on the right-hand side, a reckless side that just kind of doesn't care whether it works or not.
Yeah. Interesting. I wish we could talk about this all day because this is all very fascinating and we are coming up to the end of our time. So I wanted to ask one last question. For founders that are listening who feel stuck, maybe stuck in some of the cycles that we're talking about today, where is the first place that they should look to start breaking free?
Obviously, it's a bit of self-promotion, but I truly believe in it. I think starting with brain pattern mapping to understand where your patterns of self-deception are likely to set you up for self-sabotage or repetitive chaos is always going to be the first place to start, because there's nothing that I know of that in 20 minutes can immediately show you all of your blind spots in a way that you can actually take action on. So I really do firmly believe that that is the best first step for any founder, because it'll show you that which you cannot see right now and what to do about it.
I love that. And increase maybe your self-awareness into some of your habits and some ways that you can improve. And then after they take the assessment, then what?
So after you're done with the assessment, it'll give you an appointment booking link. You'll meet with the behavior strategist on our team that actually breaks down the whole diagnostic, explains what the recommendations are. And break method itself takes 20 weeks to go through. So most people end up continuing on to actually do the rewiring program itself. Cool. I've seen really dedicated people get through it in more like 14 weeks, but 20 weeks is really the sweet spot, because you don't want to rush something that really needs time to be embodied and actually take root in your body. So I wouldn't look at it as something that you just want to check off the box if you really want it to work for you in a sustainable way.
That makes sense. Thank you so much. This was a great conversation. For everyone listening, please share this with one person that needs to hear this, one person that you think would benefit from this conversation, and I will talk to you next time. Thank you.
Thanks, everybody.